Welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast, episode 79. I'm Mo, and I'm here with Al and Al. I don't know which one was which. How's it going?
Hi.
How you doing down there?
Good.
We're both
good.
Sat on the floor, and I'm sitting high and mighty on a chair in the corner.
Why didn't you come sit with us?
Because I like to feel like a king.
Well, you can't sit with us.
Oh, cool, fine, whatever. It's another big week in the world of metal. We're going to be taking a deep dive into the Tool album later. And when I say we, I mean Eleanor, because she likes Tool loads. And if you like Tool, you should, of course, pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer magazine. It is out right now in all UK shops. It's sold out online very, very quickly. So if you want to get the Tool edition of the mag, that comes with the free bonus 16-page Tool magazine, looking for all their early years and various other things. You need to get out into UK shops now. To find your nearest copy, you need to go to tinyurl.com/findhammer. That's tinyurl.com/findhammer. There's loads of other cool shit in it as well, including a free Killswitch Engage art print designed by Mike D, thrash metal stickers from people like Megadeth, Anthrax, Exodus, Power Trip, and that's not even getting to all the other stuff that's actually inside the mag, which there is loads. So go and pick it up right now, immediately. And yeah, speaking of all that, we're finally getting a Tool album this week. That's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time.
13 years in the making. The internet is losing its shit
in
at
fact,
the prospect
by the time
of finally
this,
getting there.
Sorry. By the time this is aired or online, you're listening, it'll be out.
Good point. It will be out right now. So, yeah, let us know what you think of it. Come to the Metal Hammer Facebook group at facebook.com/Metal Hammer Readers. As I said, Elle's going to take us through her thoughts on the Tool album Fear Inoculum in a bit. In terms of what's been going on in the news in the metal world this week, a lot of Slipknot stuff. Lot of Slipknot stuff.
Go on.
Well, first and foremost is the UK tour. Well, European tour, but with a load of UK dates on there, which is very exciting. Slipknot are coming back to the UK for a tour with Behemoth.
Yeah,
that is
going to
be
really
ridiculous.
Good.
My goodness gracious me. Are we excited for that?
I don't think you have to ask, do you?
Well, I did. Are you?
Yeah, obviously. I love the new record and I really can't wait to see them do more of it.
Yeah, it's going to be rad. And Behemoth as well. I mean, I said this on Twitter, but I think one of the really cool things about when metal bands do well and they are smashing it in the mainstream, obviously Slipknot got a number one album and so there's a lot of attention on them at the moment. To then take an unapologetically extreme metal band like Behemoth into arenas is really fucking cool, because I can't remember the last time a band like that got put on a stage that big in the UK. It's really exciting.
Yeah, and it also shuts people up who don't like the new record or think Slipknot have gone soft. Hello.
Yeah, exactly.
Have a listen to Solway Firth, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. What are you talking about? And you know, I think there's always a big thing about what it means for the metal scene at large when metal bands do well and they go a bit, you know, enter into the mainstream consensus and all of that. And this just shows that not only are Slipknot still in touch with the heavier side of the scene, but they're actively supporting it, which is great. And if ever there was an extreme metal band that could bring a show worthy of big venues, it's Behemoth.
They're playing like actual proper big venues, aren't they? In London, it's
the
O2.
Doing the O2,
yeah.
Biggest arena in London. So yeah. That's a 20,000 cap that Behemoth are going to be playing. First time I ever saw Behemoth, they were like second up on a bill at the Garage, I think, about 10 years ago. So the idea that they're now my main supporter at the O2 arena is pretty ridiculous and exciting.
How many Bibles can they burn?
Loads, probs, loads. Yeah, really, really exciting times. Also in Slipknot news this week, the band have a lot of unreleased material, which we actually, I think, kind of helped to break as a news story in our cover feature with the band late last year. A ton of songs from the 2008 sessions for All Hope Is Gone never made it to actually being released. And there's around an album's worth of material, according to some stuff that the band told us last year. Old Corey's been having a bit of a talk about it, and he says some of it sounds like Radiohead. So
I think Spiders on the new record, didn't that come from those sessions? They were led by Clown,
didn't they?
I think pretty sure, yeah. They were led by Clown, and it was sort of a breakout group during the All Hope Is Gone sessions. Clown, Corey, and a couple of the other guys got together as sort of a separate group and recorded stuff that was a bit avant-garde and weird and experimental, and I'm pretty sure Spiders started from there.
Wow, so Spiders is not really from the... We
think,
are not your kind
I think
sessions.
So. I think
such.
It's from I think it's from those days.
That is fascinating. Wow. I mean, people are making a big thing about the Radiohead comment, but I somehow imagine it's something that's been taken drastically out of context as part of an interview he said.
It probably meant it was like more experimental or something, I would guess.
Yeah, exactly. More Slipknot news. Well, kind of. Corey's also been talking about potentially doing a solo album in 2021, so he's obviously thinking pretty far ahead. I mean, he's done some solo stuff before, but a proper Corey Taylor solo album feels like something. I'm quite amazed we haven't had that yet.
Yeah. I do agree.
I left a space for you to talk there, Alice.
Oh, okay. I have nothing more to say. I'm just surprised that it hasn't happened.
I went to see, was it Stone Sour? No, it was an evening with Corey Taylor, wasn't it?
Yeah.
At Coco. And he sort of played some material on stage, some Stone Sour stuff. And then there was a Q&A from the audience. There was definitely like a lot of love in that room for Corey Taylor. And I think people will be really receptive to a solo album.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And he's kind of said it's going to run the full gauntlet of everything he has done. So there'll be softer stuff on there. There'll be heavier stuff on there. I'll be stunned if there's not some acoustic-y stuff on there as well, because I know he likes to do a bit of that. So yeah, we will see what happens. Somebody tell me some news from Metal this week that is not Slipknot related.
Okay, I shall.
Wow, he's killing it with these long pauses, guys.
The enthusiasm here is like unbelievable.
Help me out, guys. I need
some. You gave me like a look like you were going to say it. So in non-Slipknot news, Five Finger Death Punch are touring Europe supported by Megadeth.
That is
strange.
Strange? Yeah. Okay, interesting. I'm going to come back to you about that. I was about to say massive. this is not a Megadeth Five Finger Death Punch joint headline tour. This is very much a Five Finger Death Punch tour, although they have kind of half officially called it, I think, the Megadeth Punch tour. So it's definitely all about two massive bands touring together, but it does seem like Five Finger Death Punch will be headlining and Megadeth will be kind of serving in a main support kind of role, which is quite interesting, maybe. Alice called it strange.
Can you remember when they came over with Lamb of God? I saw the Birmingham show and it was Megadeth.
That was joint headliner.
Megadeth, wasn't it? But it had been, had it rotated?
I don't know if it rotated, but I'm pretty sure that was billed as a joint headliner, yeah. I think. I might have to double check that actually. But
yeah, my show was definitely Lamb of God and then Megadeth. And I can't really remember whether it was the same one of the shows or not.
No, it was, yeah, I mean, Megadeth definitely came on after Lamb of God when I...
Okay, so it's probably the same order all the time then, even if it was a joint show.
Yeah, exactly.
But this time it'll be Megadeth and then Five Finger. Which seems mad.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it does, other than Megadeth are a historically, you know, bigger and more influential metal band. I don't know if I would say that Megadeth are definitely bigger than Five Finger Death Punch in 2019.
Well, I guess Five Finger Death Punch release more frequently and have fans who are really, 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 really into it.
Yeah, they have devoted fans, definitely.
Definitely. I think people really underestimate how big that band are. You know, because they're not, because they're around all the time, like you said, Elle, they release albums a lot. I mean, a lot.
Like every year, there's another album.
Yeah, there was a period where they did, if you include the double album as two kind of albums, there was a time where they did like five albums in 6 years or something ridiculous. Yeah, so they've really got a prolific turnout, and in that time they just got bigger, especially globally. I saw them headline Welcome to Rockville in the States, and they played to a fucking massive crowd. There was about 60,000 people there just for them. It was ridiculous.
Well, I'm not going to complain because I like Five Finger Death Punch, and I'm not even going to say it's a guilty pleasure. So
no, I love Five Finger Death Punch a lot, but it's interesting to see what people make of this billing.
Yeah, I definitely feel like everyone's going to come out and think that it's weird and think that Megadeth deserve to headline because they're much more of a prestige band than Five Finger Death Punch.
I'd still say they're bigger though, like just as in like more people have heard of Megadeth, like outside of the metal community and everything.
Yeah, this is what it comes down to. What does bigger mean? Does bigger mean how many tickets you can sell? Does it mean your influence on the genre? Does it mean how many albums you've sold? I mean, Megadeth, I would assume, have definitely sold more albums than Five Finger Death Punch overall. Mm. But this is the second time that Five Finger Death Punch will be doing a tour of this size. I don't think they've officially announced what venues they're playing and all that kind of stuff, but I know they're kind of doing a slow rollout of dates on the Mega Death Punch website they've set up. So this, I mean, this is going to be an arena tour, I presume. I don't think they've announced the official venues yet, but I'm presuming it's going to be one. And if so, that would be the second kind of arena-sized dates that Five Finger Death Punch have done on these shows.
I like the name though.
Mega Death Punch. Yeah, it's solid. It's solid.
It's really good. Good merch opportunity there as well.
Yeah, definitely. Vic Rattlehead and whatever. What's that guy called? Five Finger Death Punch have that mascot as well, don't they? They should do that. They should do like a versus like fighting thing. Do you know what I mean?
Do they have two mascots
brawling. Yeah, it's like a skull and it's like...
I don't know.
Yeah, I just think of the knuckle duster thing.
They definitely have a guy. Hold on, I'm going to look him up and then find him.
The knuckle duster and how there's five of them and it makes a fist.
Yeah, and it's like...
The way of the fist.
Like,
but also, I think... I don't think that Megadeth will get anything less than a pretty long set. Like minimum an hour and a bit, I think. So it'll be like a proper decent Megadeth set. I'm sure they'll bring their own show. And the other thing is, like, yeah, a lot of people probably do know, probably know who Megadeth are, because metal fans tend to have a good, memory of the more veteran bands and stuff than other genres. But at the same time, there's probably a lot of Five Finger Death Punch fans who have got into them, who've almost got into metal through them, or see them as a band who have kind of helped them understand the scene a bit more. That might maybe have heard of Megadeth, but don't actually know many of their songs or haven't seen them before. And this will be a good opportunity for them to kind of check them out, you know?
That is true.
As does happen, It's a good thing when bands can support each other. That's what I think about this kind of stuff. And the mascot is called...
Go on.
Knucklehead.
Oh, okay. So Knucklehead and Vic Rattlehead. Knucklehead versus Rattlehead.
Yeah, come on. You know this guy, right?
Which guy? Hold on, I'm gonna... Go on, show me his picture.
That guy.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, right? There you go. Him. He's like a skull dude with like a foot. That's why Ivan Moody's always got like the handprint on his head. It's the skull guy with the handprint on his head. So, yeah.
Well, I don't understand.
So, if no one's thought of that yet, and I'm sure someone has, we want a knucklehead versus Vic Rattlehead. Two heads as well. Come on, this has got to be made. This is not perfect. Someone do this artwork. I will buy that t-shirt. I'll buy the shit out of it. So, yeah, dates are slowly being revealed on megadeathpunch.com, and we'll have all the latest info on that tour on metalhammer.com as well. That's all coming later this year. But, yeah, really excited. Megadeth and Five Finger Death Punch. Fuck yes. Two brilliant bands touring together. I am happy with that. Shall we talk about this Orange Goblin situation?
Yes. You might have to...
Pants.
You might have to fill us in a bit here. So,
yeah.
The band announced their drummer Chris Turner will miss their upcoming US tour due to an issue with his visa application.
Yes.
So that's happening. Yes. So he's not going on the tour because he's got a visa problem.
I think the tour is underway as we speak as well. It's kind of rolling onwards at the moment, or in the very, very near future at least.
So they've got Chad Walls to fill in instead.
Yeah. And there's a kind of run of six shows. They're getting scheduled to get underway, this week. So they are going ahead as planned. They've had a Chad Walls who's coming in to fill in for Chris. Chris is a longtime member of the band as well. And obviously Orange Goblin are pissed off about this because according to them, what they've said in their statement is that they started the visa application process months ago. They were giving a last minute embassy appointment. With Chris told that he'd have to provide a ton of information for administrative processing. Again, the band say that he already had six working US visas, has a US social security number. Obviously, working as a band in the US, you need to have a lot of stuff in place for that to work. It's not an easy process to get going. But the band also said in a statement that the extra info they asked of him included 15 years international travel history, every single Orange Goblin show outside the UK, every single personal family holiday Chris has taken, 15 years address history, 15 years employment history, all the names and birthdays and family, every phone number and email address that he's used in the last 15 years, loads and loads and loads of info that Orange Goblin have said that they were required to give to be able to get Chris on this US tour. And ultimately, he still wasn't able to make it through, which is a real shame. So I don't know if there'll be more news on that soon. But in the meantime, if you are in the US and you happen to be on that run of dates, which I think are kind of running over into the West Coast area at the moment, but go onto Orange Goblin's website or onto metalhammer.com to check out Orange Goblin's list of US dates that they're going through now. And if you can get to one, go to one, go buy some merch, shout about the show, pick up their albums, because they are one of the greatest British heavy metal bands of the last 20 plus years, and they really deserve your support. And it's a real shame that one of their, you know, a real core member of the band hasn't been able to go and not just experience this with them, but I don't know if he's going to lose money through that or what it is. So it's a bit of a bum thing that's happened to them. So if you can support Orange Goblin, go and support them, because they are one of the best bands going, period. And they deserve to be not having to put up with poo situations like this.
That's a serious amount of personal information as well. So much is required. Obviously, when you do visa applications, they do require a certain level of information, but that is really serious amount of information.
Did they give any reason as to, like, why?
I don't think they know, do they?
Or it's justification?
They've just...
And how come the other guys got through fine?
No idea.
That's what I was wondering. It's weird that one of them wasn't through. But they insisted he didn't have a criminal record. Criminal record. Oh, God, that should be easier to say. Yeah, they said he doesn't have a criminal record. He's not affiliated with any political group or organisation. He hasn't travelled to a blacklisted country or anything like that. So, yeah, no idea why this is happening.
You don't always know either, do you? I think it says on the US visa website that you can't always get details of why they've rejected your application. Like, they won't tell you.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm. Well, maybe they're just not Orange Goblin fans. Or just not fans of drumming.
What a shame.
That is a shame. But yeah, as you said, go support Orange Goblin if you can. If you're listening to this from America and you're near or nearabouts one of those shows, get down to them. And even if you're not, go see Orange Goblin next time they're near you and go pick up some merch, because they are the tits. The absolute tits.
Say tits again.
Tits.
What is happening? Anyway.
I was going to let you do the
on
link.
That note.
Oh, but I don't know where to go with that now. Are we going to talk about the Tool album?
Let's talk about the Tool album. Fear Inoculum is finally upon us. Oh, my word. Now, we've been able to sit with it a little bit longer because we went to like a couple of listening sessions a while back. So we've kind of formulated some thoughts. And as I've said, Elle's probably best place to give them, because she's a Tool fanatic.
At the beginning.
And did the amazing cover feature, which you can read in the new issue where we actually talked to the band. So yeah, Fear Inoculum is here. What is your take on this album, Elle? It's 13 years. Was it worth the wait? What are you saying about it?
Yeah, I think I mentioned last week, it's sort of Tool, but even more Tool. The songs are longer. They're kind of exploring a lot of different things. It feels almost like a sort of continuation of Lateralis. Obviously, they've had 10,000 days in the meantime, but a lot of the sort of themes and the feel of it are quite Lateralis-y. There's sort of echoes of Schism and Parabola and stuff on there as well. Should we talk about some of the tracks? It might be easier.
Yeah, go for it.
Being a bit vague.
What stands out for you?
Well, obviously the title track, Fear Inoculum, that's the one that's out in the wild. That came out a few weeks back, mm-hmm. So everyone will have heard that by now. And I'd say that's fairly representative of the record as a whole. It kind of starts off and builds and builds and builds into different layers, and it's kind of like almost quite restrained, but there is a lot going on still mm-hmm. at the same time. Numa, the second track, that's my favourite track, I think.
Really?
At the moment, yeah. So it's quite... The riff in it is quite memorable. Danny said that's one of the first things they wrote for the record. And again, it really reminds me of Lateralis. It kind of sounds a bit like The Patient, a bit like the extended part of Schism that they play when they do it live. And lyrically, the first track, it sort of talks about exhaling contagion and kind of exercising things and getting things out of yourself. And then Numa, that word actually means a person's vital spirit, soul, or creative energy. From Greek, it means breath, spirit, wind. So it's kind of this idea, it sort of flows, like Fear Inoculum is kind of talking about exercising and expelling things, and then Numa almost talks about kind of the breath, and they kind of flow and link into each other. And for me, there's sort of this idea of connectivity there as well between humans. It says in the lyrics, Numa, reach out beyond, wake up, remember, we are born of one breath, one word, we are all one spark, eyes full of wonder. So I kind of like that. It's interesting. And I feel like it's maybe continuing what Maynard was doing on A Perfect Circle's Eat the Elephant that was out last year. So that had a lot of stuff in it about kind of putting down social media and reconnecting with people and doing things that are worthwhile. And we spoke to him on that record for Hammer, and he said that you're missing out on a lot of connection if you believe you have to kind of do all these things like the kind of distractions like social media. Or there's a line in So Long and Thanks for All the Fish where it talks about diets, lawyers, shrinks and apps and flags and plastic surgery. So kind of all these like distractions in modern life, if you're just focusing on those kinds of things and not on real life and connecting with people, you're missing out. So I sort of feel there's a bit of a connection here between those lyrical themes about that kind of thing of human connectivity and being present in the moment and all that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're kind of interesting. I thought they were sort of quite chilled, almost like quite kind of ritualistic. They sort of kind of have that sort of flow where they're sort of calming and kind of lulling, and yeah, they're kind of ones to sort of sit back and take in. And then there's another track we haven't heard yet, which comes after these two.
Is that the bonus track?
It's an interlude. So on the digital edition, there's an interlude called Litany contre la peur. And that's probably like litany against fear, isn't it, in French? Yeah, but I've not heard that.
Oui.
But I'm imagining from the other interludes, it's probably some kind of electronic thing. We'll have to listen to that when it comes out. And then Invincible, that's one of the ones they've played live. And that talks about the warrior struggling to remain relevant. And we chatted a bit in the cover feature about how they've had this 13-year wait for the record, and the band kind of talks about getting older and what that means. So I feel like that might be sort of a little bit of a personal one as well, like talking about how you remain relevant as you get older and how that all connects with each other. And the intro to that is quite long, and there isn't any bass for the first 4 minutes. And in our cover feature, Justin Chancellor told this really nice story. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
So he says kind of that he was playing the song on stage, but because he doesn't do anything for 4 minutes, he was pointing at the crowd and people were clapping. And Maynard asked him if he could stop doing it because he found it distracting. And Justin was like, well, I think they're just clapping along with the song. But he stopped pointing at people. And the next night they clapped along anyway. So they were literally just clapping along with a polyrhythm.
In your face,
that's
Maynard.
That's what Tool fans do. They clap a polyrhythm.
In your face.
And Justin said he flipped him off. So there you go. Legion Inoculant, that's another interlude. This one is really weird. I just wrote down, sounds like the inside of a spacecraft with mangled voices and sound inside of it. It sounds like an alien being born. There's loads of feedback, loads of electronic noises that you get when you turn a frequency dial on a radio, and weird pulsing noises like you get in an aquarium. I think I was thinking about like when you're inside like a tunnel of fish and there's kind of these like weird sounds above you. But that's all I remember.
Obviously you'd have to compare it to fish.
Just because I like fish
so on brand
doesn't mean I need to bring them into everything. But yeah, I mean, that one, I can't really remember it, but that's what I wrote down. It was just kind of quite a weird one. It sounded, yeah, like aliens being born underwater. That's what I'm going to go with. Mm. Descending's another one they've played on stage. And that kind of reminds me a bit of Wings for Marie Part 1 from 10,000 Days. And a bit of You Lied, which is a track that they covered from Justin's old band Peach. Ooh. And this one I really like as well, actually, but it's taken a really long time because when I first saw it, I was like, yeah, it's kind of cool, but I don't really know what to grab onto. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was no kind of like massive climactic bit or massive hook where I could really feel like I was drawn into it. So I kind of just was a bit lukewarm. But having heard it recorded, I actually think it's quite cool. It's kind of, again, it's quite like lulling and dreamlike, and the lyrics are about being heedless in our slumber and having boundlessness and this madness of our own making. And it's kind of like this track that starts out quite soft and kind of mimicking that sort of dreamlike feel, but actually all the lyrics about us being really apathetic about things and how if we don't change our situation and make decisions, we're basically all going to die.
Well,
so you kind of think it's this sort of like dreamlike sort of, you know, I don't know, like fairly ambivalent or just relaxing sort of a song. And then you're like, hang on a minute. It's basically saying we're sleepwalking into our doom, which is pretty mel. But I'm guessing that's why it's called descending. You know, it's like we're sort of going into this bad place, and there's only so far you can fall before you reach the bottom, and then that's it. So yeah, I mean, that kind of reminded me again of the Last Perfect Circle record, that kind of thing of being political with a small p, just social and political, and kind of talking about the decisions we make and the things that we do and where it takes us and how we kind of have to wake up to these things, or we're just going to sleepwalk into some hideous disaster. Which is cool. It's, you know, it's kind of that thing of, it sort of tricks you almost into a message without you realizing that you've heard it. And this is interesting as well, because when we came out of the playback, Merlin, I remember you saying something like, oh, you felt like Maynard didn't really sing on as much of it.
Yeah, it was kind of like, it wasn't even, yeah, I mean, I don't think he felt like he sung much on it. And I just felt like he didn't feel as present overall on it. Like, when he comes in, it's beautiful, and he's one of the very best vocalists that Mel's ever had. But it's almost like I felt like with the A Perfect Circle album, so much of it was about Maynard, like so much of the vocal melodies and the kind of sombre tone of it and everything else. Whereas with this one, it felt like he was just kind of one of many ingredients rather than a central part of it all to me.
I think it's quite interesting because in this song, that's why I sort of mentioned it, is that he stopped singing halfway through. It's a 13-minute song and he's kind of finished his parts. And then you kind of get these, like, you get like a big jam, you get these spacey electronics that kind of sound like an old sci-fi film. And when they play it live, you kind of get this big pyramid visual on the stage, which was like, ooh, you know, what's going to happen? It's sort of apocalyptic. So it's really interesting because it's sort of this proggy song that you don't think has got much to it at the beginning. And then actually there's sort of this kind of urgency and this message behind it, which is really nice. But again, I spoke to Maynard on that Perfect Circle record, and we sort of talked about a sense of space, because I felt like on that record, it was on Eat the Elephant, it was quite restrained as well, and there was no point where he kind of really came out and screamed. And he said to me about that record, that's because what you're hearing on the front end is all of that. That's your first introduction to the entire album, is the quiet parts. Basically, that's what an interior decorator does. They set up the feng shui for you and they set the mood. It's all there on the albums. You were manipulated by feng shui. Which I thought was quite funny, because
such a tall thing to say.
I know. But it almost did make sense in that when you look beyond what you think is quiet or what you think is restrained, there's actually kind of more to it, which I think is what he's getting at. And I feel like that's on this album a little bit, that kind of sense of setting the scene and pulling back the camera. And, you know, there's actually a lot going on underneath. So, Culling Voices, this is kind of where it gets to its most kind of angry. It's kind of an interesting one. Like, I couldn't help but think of Donald Trump when I listened to this one. It kind of seems like it's about people who kind of have negative imaginary, that's a hard word to say, negative imaginary conversations with people in their own heads. So he says, disembodied voices deepen my suspicious tendencies. Conversations we've never had. Imagined interplay. Psychopathy. Don't you dare point that at me. So it kind of feels almost like somebody making something up in their head and perceiving a threat, when actually that person hasn't even heard their voice heard. But, you know, this person's kind of presumed something negative about it. And I wondered if Culling Voices was kind of a reference to silencing people by imagining the things they've said instead of actually listening to them.
Interesting.
But maybe I'm just going too deep. I don't know.
You're going too deep for Tool. No layers to that, man.
I've got a bit English literature on that one. But, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Who knows?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Dig it.
And then, yeah, it gets quite heated. And I kind of like the fact it sort of does suddenly break through a bit of that feng shui and kind of goes for it a little bit more. You know, his voice gets quite angry.
Mm.
And then we've got chocolate chip trip. That's really hard to say. Can you say that?
That's chocolate chip trip.
Can you say it, Alice?
Chocolate chip trip.
Fine. But yeah, it's like it's sort of like a woozy interlude, and it's essentially a drum solo wrapped in electronics, and Danny Carey has been playing it live. You might have seen on set lists as CC Trip. And because it's Tool, it's not really your average drum solo. It kind of just goes really experimental and weird. Danny told us it's sort of a tribute to a fusion and jazz drumming guy called Billy Cobham, and it's a nod to him and the things that he's done before. And it also is in Seven with him soloing over the top in Seven. And he told us in our cover feature that Seven is kind of a thing on this record. They've got time signatures in Seven. They've had the seven-pointed star. And I'm pretty sure he said something to us that was really enigmatic, like drawing a six-sided star is really easy, but drawing a seven-sided star is more complex.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was a bit like, okay, that makes sense, but also I'm confused. So there's a lot going on with Seven in the record. So when you listen to it, it's probably something to look out for as well, that kind of symbolism and those kind of time signatures. And this one is really kind of like, yeah, it does feel very trippy. Although he also said it was fueled by chocolate chip cookies more than it was acid. So there you go. Nice. If you want to be in Tool, just eat a load of chocolate chip cookies. I'm sure it's that easy.
I do that regularly.
Yeah,
I'm me very too. In touch with my prog metal inner being.
Then we've got Tempest, spelt with a seven. This one also feels quite political to me. I like the intro. It says, keep calm, here we go again. And that kind of encapsulated some of how I felt about the record, with the beginning being kind of calmer and this thing about the breath and being connected, and then going towards the end of the album where it's more kind of a little bit heated and sort of talking about some people who maybe have some problems interacting with people and are causing difficulties for the world. And yeah, it's kind of the rockiest of the songs. It actually sort of sounds quite rocky, like electric guitar solo-y sort of rocky.
It's quite climactic in that sense.
Yeah, again, it feels a bit more like they're actually sort of letting some anger out, letting something out. Definitely feels again like it could be about Donald Trump or other world leaders, talking about somebody who pretends that everything's okay but actually you can see through him and the shitstorm is about to go down. So yeah, that is quite cool. And obviously a tempest is a violent storm, so it could be about that, or there could be some other layer of symbolism to a tempest. I don't know. Somebody tell us if there is. Not sure. Can't really see if there's another hidden meaning there.
You can go even deeper than L.
Yes. Maybe it's to do with Shakespeare's A Tempest. I don't know. That was about rival factions. They were sort of fighting, weren't they? And there was a witch in that, so that's cool.
Useful bit of pop quiz info.
Witch's son, actually, not a witch. And then, yeah, the end of the record is Mocking Beats, which I like the play on words there. It's kind of cool. It's sort of very Tool, isn't it? It's sort of a bit sly, and it's like Mocking Bird, you know, making fun of something, but Mocking Beat because it's music. There you go. It's kind of a pun.
There you go.
And
how did you work that one out? You have done your homework.
But yeah, I kind of like it. It's sort of like a chirping bird sound. It sort of recalls the crickets at the end of Undertow, which is their first record. And
love it when bands do that. Those little callbacks. I remember Sabbath did that on 13. I just thought it's a really cool. It's a bit of like almost like a cheap emotional hit, but it totally works.
It definitely made me think of it, whether that was the intention or not. And yeah, I just think overall it's a really interesting record. I think it definitely returns to some of the themes of Lateralis and some of Maynard's stuff in Perfect Circle. Definitely feel like there's a lot of bits, again, like sonically from Lateralis, but also the 10,000 Days stuff in terms of the length of the songs and the pacing of the songs. And definitely that feeling of space that we were talking about, how there is chance for things to breathe in between the vocals and the connection between the guitars and the bass, and that Danny's drumming is always obviously mad. Like, he's an amazing drummer, but he could just as easily pull back and do something really simple. They use tabla quite a lot. And yeah, so I definitely enjoy it. I think it's a really good addition to their discography.
What do you think is it everything you hope for? Do you feel kind of satisfied with it as a piece of work?
I think it's sort of what I expected without really having any expectations. I think it kind of follows on from what they've been doing and just takes it to the logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. I definitely like it now more, well, like on the second listen we had than the first listen, because I felt like it was just sinking in a lot more, whereas the first time was just kind of loud and like, I don't know what is going on. And I definitely think it's one of those records that the more you listen to it, the more you dig into it, the more you appreciate it. It's not really something you can just have on in the background and go, oh, I've heard the Tool record. You kind of have to actually sit down and listen to it and have a little bit of patience. And it, again, I guess it's a little bit like, probably shouldn't keep comparing it to a Perfect Circle, but you know, that's kind of the last time we spoke to Maynard, and they're another band that is, you know, I really enjoy. It sort of reminds me a little bit about how their first couple of records went in and felt sort of very intense and passionate and emotional, and then Eat the Elephant pulled back and was a bit more objective and a bit more political. And this to me feels, you know, it's not the Tool of Undertow or Unima. It's not kind of raging singles or raging anger or kind of just getting things out or being sarcastic or telling a story in that way. It's much more kind of pulled back, considered, talking about wider issues. It feels more grown up at the end of the day, and that's often what happens with bands, isn't it? You know, you get older, your perspective changes a bit, you think about your own mortality, as dark as that sounds, which they spoke to us about a little bit, and you do something more like this, and it doesn't mean it's not as good, it means it's different.
There you go. That was Elle's deep take on the album itself. Don't forget to pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer to read her fascinating interview with the band themselves. Loads of really interesting anecdotes and stories and insight into the dynamic of what went into making Fear Inoculum. And there's another review of the album in there as well. Not by Elle, if you want a different take. And we're going to be publishing a full track-by-track kind of guide to the album as well on the website this week. For all things Tool, you know that we are the mag and the brand to follow. Oh, that nearly sounded cool then. I fucked it up at the end.
Which means to talk about Tool some more.
All things Tool, we're the place to be, whether it's in the magazine or online or right on here. So there you go.
I should say as well that the tracks I was talking about there all on the digital edition. So that has three extra tracks from what the physical edition has.
Yeah, true. Yeah, what do you think? What do we think about the seemingly the only physical copy you can get of it at the moment is the £80 CD or like 70
with
quid
the
CD?
Weird digital screen.
It's a digital screen. Yeah. That's really interesting, isn't it? So like going all in on physical. It's like if you want to buy this album physically, you fucking buy it. Like, you buy the shit out of it.
I know, it's basically that. It's basically you've just got to go all in, haven't you, if you want it. You
yeah. know? But I mean, there'll be a regular CD version at some point, I'm sure, right? And like a nice vinyl. I don't know. Maybe not.
Mm. I've been too immersed in the world to actually look up what the options are apart from the crazy
screen. I can't see any evidence that there's a regular CD version you can buy at the moment. That I can see. So
because it comes with a download code, doesn't it, if you get the crazy
one. You get the crazy one. Very cool. As always, Tool are only doing things their way. Let's take some reader questions from facebook.com/metalhammerreaders. Someone do the first one.
Well, I've just talked for about 1,000 hours, so someone else should probably do it.
Okay, so Finn Mr. 101.
It's Finn Meister.
Okay, Finnmeister 101. Now that festival season is over, what has been the best festival for you or your highlights? For me, it was Slipknot at Download and watching a mosh pit circle a guy dressed as a fridge at 2,000 trees.
So a mosh pit.
200 trees. Oh, gosh.
basically.
That's a slightly less good version down the road.
So basically, there was a guy dressed as a fridge and a bunch of people were like moshing around him.
Yeah, looks like it.
Oh, wow. So that was Finnmeister 101. That was his festival highlight. What have been your festival highlights then? We've all been to a few different festivals to each other as well, so we could have a good mix of stuff here.
Oh, you can just guess mine.
Tool at Download.
Yeah, it was Tool at Download.
Oh, okay, there you go then.
So, I probably didn't want to hear any more about Tool now, but I thought it was really good. And I'd already seen them in Berlin, but it was nice to see them outside the different setting and a load of people who had seen it for the first time, etc. And having the big screens up, but no camera following them around like you'd usually have for a festival, I thought looked really cool.
Nice.
And probably would have been Slipknot as well, but I couldn't see very well from where I was. Probably you and Steve just standing in front of me the whole time.
Sorry for being tall. My bad.
But yeah, I really enjoyed that as well. I just didn't, it wasn't you guys, but we didn't have quite as good a place to watch them from. So I think I felt a bit like...
Like next to me.
I know, but it wasn't as good a place as what I had for Tool, is all I'm saying.
Okay. Alice, choices? Best festival moments this summer?
Well, I've been to quite a lot of festivals.
Yes, you have.
So I'd probably say I loved Midgar's Blot. That's probably like a highlight.
Mm.
The whole like opening ceremony and like experiencing that was really, really huge because I'd wanted to do it for so long. So that's probably like my major highlight. Yeah. And I guess I also really liked seeing Behemoth at Download on the main stage. That was pretty cool.
I missed that. I missed tons of stuff that day because our trains were all buggered.
Yeah.
I saw them.
Yeah, it was really good. Yeah. It was just so massive. It was just really cool to see like a more extreme band on the main stage. Yeah.
It was like a big dark presence had just come over the field. And
it was cool.
We're like, we're here now, bringing the darkness. That's exactly how they sound.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, as I said, I missed a lot of the first day of Dana, which was annoying, but it was totally worth it because I think in terms of like a defining festival moment this summer, I think it is probably Slipknot at Download because it was just, it felt so celebratory. I think after that 2009 Download set, it was easily the best I've seen them. It was the first time I've seen them at Download since the 2009 set where I kind of felt like it had its own identity in a way, if you know what I mean. Like, I can't really, apart from one of them being really fucking rainy, I can't really recall particular highlights between the other sets that have happened.
No, it's almost like it's all kind of like angles, isn't it? Like the first one was the first time, yeah, and then the other ones were kind of good, but there wasn't,
they did
like
one obviously that had been since Paul had died, and that was emotional. But they'd kind of paid that tribute at Sonosphere, so it was slightly different. It wasn't quite as emotional in the same way. But this time it was just like, oh, look, one of the best metal bands of all time have turned up and they've got some ripping new tracks and the stage show looks cool and Corey is on the form of his life and they're just utterly smashing it. And I honestly don't know if there's a better opening song in the history of metal than People Equal Shit for a live set.
Oh, it's so good.
It's just so good. And it just felt good. Like, it just felt like, obviously, there was a really good day of build up with like Trivium and Behemoth and all these killer metal bands and Deanbud. but yeah, it would culminate in this, just it's the kind of thing that Download is all about, and I thought that was really cool.
Actually, in that set as well, they played Unsainted, and when I put the record on now, it makes me think of them live.
Yeah, it was really
Download.
Cool.
It sort of flicks a switch in my brain and makes me feel really excited. Yeah. So that was weird how that very quickly just felt normal.
Playing Get This as well, like such a savage opening few songs they went with.
Yeah, there were loads of savage ones actually, weren't there?
It was a really heavy set. They,
oh,
well,
it's
we said
bringing
it, at the
it
time,
back now.
They didn't even play Left Behind or My Plague, I don't think, did they? So it's like two of their biggest tracks. Or maybe they played. They didn't play Left Behind or they didn't play Wait and Bleed. So they didn't play two of their biggest songs, arguably their two most famous songs, not called Duality.
That
but
actually
it was still
a really
amazing.
Good set. I really loved it.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Glad to have cleared that for you. honourable shout outs for Danny Filth walking out on stage at All Points East.
Yeah.
It was just so surreal in a field of kind of essentially Bring Me the Horizon fans, like a Quartz painted Danny Filth pushing a trolley about on the main stage at Victoria Park was just so surreal.
I still love that they did
really
that video where
it.
They were just like, oh, what should we do? Let's get Danny Filth in Quartz paint and he can push a trolley through a supermarket because
yeah,
he's
wicked.
Got ennui.
Very cool. Obviously, Parkway at Bloodstock was really cool to see that. That was a hell of a show as well. And also, actually, Gojira at Glastonbury was a massive personal highlight. Just to see such a great and vital metal band in a completely different surrounding was really, really cool. So I really enjoyed that as well.
Wait to hear their next record.
If I'm allowed to pick a not metal one, then Dave at Glastonbury, because that was one of the best things I saw all summer.
I don't even know who he is. I'm sorry. I know he's really mainstream, but...
Don't worry about it. He's not really mainstream. He's grime.
He's mainstream.
Totally still underground.
Not sure it is.
You know, he played like Brixton Academy just after that. So.
Yeah.
At Female Pheromone asks, why is the Slipknot tour so expensive? £64 for a standing ticket in Birmingham. I'm going to sound like a dick for saying this. Is that expensive by arena gig ticket standards now? Is that about average?
I feel like it's average for an arena.
It's a lot of money, for sure.
I felt really
not something everyone can just dish out.
Buying the Rammstein tickets, that was the last like big tour ticket that I bought. I bought the Coventry ones after the Milton Keynes ones. I'm pretty sure they were like £75, and then with booking they're like £80 or something. And that felt like massively difficult. But at the same time, as we kind of spoke about, they've got loads of pyro and a huge show, so you kind of go, actually, they sort of need to pay for that. And so I guess Slipknot being like, what, £10 less than that, you're kind of like, yeah, that kind of sounds like a sort of arena show
type
like thing.
Because it's going to be a big arena
they're gonna
show.
They're going to bring
as
production
well.
As well. Like, obviously not Rammstein pyro. But...
And obviously, you know, no offense to those piano people who were supporting Rammstein, but it's a proper support act. Like,
exactly.
Behemoth are a
big band in their own right. They play like the Forum now, so they pull a couple of thousand people in their own right.
And there's 9 members in Slipknot, so everyone has to get paid.
Tortilla Man needs to pay his mortgage, right?
And all of that.
Without Tortilla Man, it would have been £40, but he's got higher
exactly
needs.
He's got every night he needs to have fresh bread on his rider.
Exactly, fresh breads, freshly baked.
Yeah, I don't know. It is hard.
Black M&Ms.
You look back at your old gig tickets and you're like, oh, remember when I saw this band for £10? So you're kind of, you know, I get the feels, but in a world where increasingly people are putting on bigger shows with more and more production, I guess that's what we have to pay.
And they're not making money off album sales anymore. Yeah. I think that's really important, and people take that for granted. The booking fees and stuff, that's a slightly different conversation, and I get that. It's quite frustrating to suddenly get paying another £10 for a ticket that you're just printing off at home anyway. But very few of us are buying a copy of every album we listen to, and there is a knock-on effect for that. And you know, something if you want to see a big band and you've not even pay for their music, again, metalheads are pretty good for this. Generally speaking, we've got actually a really good track record of paying for physical products, so it's not taking a dig at us, but bands still need to, you know, support themselves. And when you're a big machine like Slipknot, that's a lot of working parts that need to get worked out. So there we go.
There is one bonus of buying a ticket now as well for a gig in January, is that when you're all broke and sad in January, you'll have already got a ticket for something fun.
True. Mm-hmm. That it's always nice to have stuff to look forward to in January, actually. I picked this next question out because it means we can plug something in the new issue, so he's right.
Uddy Boy 1 asks, how fecking good is the new Sacred Reich album? Manifest Reality is brutal.
It is absolutely excellent. You are correct. And that is part of the reason why we did a big old interview with Sacred Reich about their comeback and the new album in the current issue of Metal Hammer. It's out right now.
It's really good.
We do pay attention to these things. We
it actually do. Made me excited.
This is one of the hardest questions ever, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I honestly can't think of anything.
Do you want to read it out? Because I've thought of a couple of answers for this.
I can't
one,
even so. Think question. Of one. Okay. So what's your worst title track on a metal album? I mean, does Iowa really add anything except length to one of the greatest records of all time? Asks Aidan Delaney.
It's really... I was like, guys, we really need to think about some answers for this week's podcast. Like,
yeah, I couldn't even.
I don't know
think
what to do
one.
For this question. I got a couple though. I was a fairly good shout. It's not one of the things I necessarily sit in. I mean, it's an immersive experience of a track, but it's not one I'll stick on out of, you know, if I'm just putting on some Slipknot bangers to get me hyped for something. Did you have any?
Well, related to the Slipknot one, Audio Secrecy, Stone Sour, that's just an instrumental and it's quite boring, I think. I don't know, it doesn't really get me hyped or anything, it's just kind of there.
I couldn't tell you which Stone Sour album that
it's
is, to be honest.
It's the opener.
No, I couldn't tell you which Stone Sour album that is.
Oh, right. It's got some...
That's the one, is that the one before or after the House of Gold concept one? House of Gold... And
Bones 1 and 2. Yeah. I feel like it was before them.
Okay, cool.
But don't trust me because my brain's unreliable. But yeah, I just felt like that was, I don't know, I didn't love it, but it's fine. It's just, I didn't love it. And then I thought maybe Bullet for My Valentine, The Poison, because that record's got a lot of other songs that were more of a hit, like Forwards to Choke Upon, All These Things I Hate, Revolve Around Me, Tears Don't Fall. If you're a Bullet fan, you probably like those more than The Poison.
Yeah, sounds about right. It's a hard question because I was
it's
like,
really hard.
God, okay, think of some Metallica albums. Ride the Lightning, one of my favourite tracks. Master of Puppets, one of the greatest tracks ever. Okay, think of some Maiden tracks and it's like Iron Maiden, a classic song. Killers, a classic song. Number of the Beast, classic song. I did find a couple of Maiden tracks that I think buck the trend when it comes to title tracks. Given that it's arguably my favourite Maiden album, feels like a bit of a stupid one to pick, but out of all the tracks on Seven Son of a Seven Son... If I was asked at gunpoint to get rid of one, I would almost definitely get rid of the title track for that song, purely because it is super long and doesn't have for me the immediacy or the emotional kind of heart-stirring melodic impact of Evil That Men Do or Infinite Dreams, etc. So I'd probably say Seven Son is the least excellent song on that album, but it is pretty much an album of 9 and 10s out of 10s. And also Dance of Death by Maiden as well. I actually think Dance of Death as a whole is really underrated in their canon. I think there's a load of brilliant songs on there, like Passchendaele's on there. It's one of the best songs they've ever written. New Frontier's great. Monster Girl is a fucking fantastic song. Facing the Sand's a brilliant song. Rainmaker's a brilliant song. Dance of Death is not quite so much a brilliant song. I feel like that's when they let their pagan diddly diddly side get a bit mad. It basically goes kind of full prog geek fantasy metal. And for Maiden, that's saying quite a lot. I still like some of the parts of that song. I remember it being live. I quite liked it and all that. But I again, if I had to leave a couple of tracks on that album on the cutting room floor, that would probably be one of them. Another one that came up because it really ended up informing my opinion of the album as a whole, which I actually think does have quite a lot going for it. And I think there's elements of Silence in the Snow that they then brought out into The Sin and the Sentence that really work in terms of some more like properly heavy metal thunder bits and some of Heafy's vocal tricks. I think he kind of then takes out and makes better on the album that followed it. But overall, even though I think the album has got some good stuff on it, I think Silence in the Snow, the song is just bad. I can't get into it at all. I actually went back to listen to it and I was just like, this just isn't good. If this was just some random power metal band, I would never have listened to this song again.
It's quite slow.
It's just so like, da 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 da, like.
It's because he was.
I don't know what it is about it. Heafy's voice sounds good, and it's you know, it's quite heavy and it's riffy, but it's just, those elements all together just don't click for me on that track at all.
Well, it's because he had vocal problems and learned to sing, isn't it? So that record is all singing, and so he just
I don't
a
have
track
a problem with the singing though. It's just
singing.
It's just it feels like laborious to listen to. It's very like dum 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 dum.
It's kind of stately, just, isn't it?
But yeah, stately is a really good word
for it. It's stately, and it kind of just keeps going at the same pace. There's not a lot of variation in it. There's not a lot where you go like, whoa, what's happening there? It's just kind of, it is what it is.
Yeah fair. That's what I think.
There you go.
Renee Hewer asks, if Roadrunner were to do another Roadrunner United project, who would you want as team captain?
This one's really hard as well.
It is, because I had to look up who's on Roadrunner nowadays, because they're different. Some bands are on a slightly different label in different countries and stuff, so I wasn't sure what counted.
Oh, well, would they have to be on Roadrunner now?
Yes.
Yeah, see, like, I've got ones that were on Roadrunner, but like...
Well, who would be on your all-time Roadrunner?
Why doesn't it count? They've got hardly any bands now. I was like, no, I don't care about any of these.
What?
Well, some of them. But
should we say who the original captains were? So the original captains were Slipknot drummer Jerry Jordison, Trivium frontman and guitarist Matt Heafy, Fear Factory guitarist Dino Cazares, and Machine Head frontman and guitarist Rob Flynn.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Roadrunner United was a thing put together to celebrate Roadrunner's 20th anniversary? 20th, I want to say 20th. 20th or 25th. And they basically got tons of Roadrunner alumni and people from the label to get together and jam out some new songs together.
I still love how you can't say alumni.
Alumni. Fuck, so I did it again.
So alumni.
I did it again. Alumni.
Like alumni and Illuminati.
I'm going to start saying aluminium like aluminum.
Aluminum. But yeah, there were four,
alumni.
There are four team captains chosen to lead 57 artists from 45 past and present Roadrunner bands.
Oh, so they did
past
they did past and present.
Bands.
Oh, okay, so that's
you
cool.
Have it then.
Yes.
Go on.
This makes me happier. I think I did it right then. Yeah.
What are your picks?
So I put King Diamond.
Oh, that's very
such
you.
A good pick. That'd be awesome.
And then I also put Danzig.
Oh, mate, this is great. This is so metal and, well, punk, I guess.
And then I put Rob Zombie.
Oh, good. Amazing.
And Jerry Cantrell.
Jerry
that is amazing.
Yeah. Hasn't Chains on Roadrunner?
Yeah, he was like, I think it was his single.
Oh, so that's like, that's yeah. A bit sly, but we'll
that lineup's really good, though.
That is really good.
What kind of music would they make?
I love how you got
I
a bunch
don't
of,
know,
like,
but it would be great.
You got a bunch of proper, like monstrous looking goths, and they're like grungy, mate.
Yeah.
I would love, you know, when people say, what's your ideal dinner party? Like, who would you go to a dinner party with? I'd love to go to a party with them.
Yeah, it would
so
be great.
Much fun.
Fuck yeah.
Al, who have you got?
I've got, well, okay, I'm just going to explain them because they're not as, I don't know, it doesn't sound as cool as yours now, but it's a current lineup. And I went for, instead of Jerry Jordison on drums, I went for Mario Duplantier because he's amazing and he's got like 1,000 arms and can play really well. So I just thought he'd be really good.
Excellent choice.
And he's also really arty and paints drum heads and does pictures and stuff. So he'd be really good at contributing to like the way the package looked and the arty side of it as well. Okay.
So you kind of had an art director.
No, I just think it'd be really good. He also does Evil Mario. I think it'd be a good, like, he's a very good natured person, a very talented musician. So I think he'd bring everyone together really well and have a good perspective on things. I've thought about this, Merlin. Don't take it away from me.
You pick someone because they're good natured. I like that.
You've got to be able to get along.
Come on, guys. This sound got to be wholesome.
If you're a team captain.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I did not pick wholesome characters.
Well, I've not finished yet, so you can't do yours until I've finished. All right, okay. So I also picked Matt Heafy again, because I thought it'd be good to have like a bit of continuity, and he's a really solid hand. Like, he's obviously can sing and play guitar and is good at songs. So I just thought he'd be kind of a good all-rounder to have, and they're still on Roadrunner. Mm-hmm. And then I picked, for the guitarist, I picked Reba Mayers from Code Orange, because I thought she would bring some like more kind of modern stuff to it, and the fact that she can play guitar and sing would be good, because Dino in the last version obviously is a guitarist but not a singer, so I thought that would be cool that she could do both and have input on both. And then for the frontman one, the other frontman, I picked Corey just because he's a really good all-rounder and is good at vocals.
Fair picks.
Can't argue with any of those. I've got a clown from Slipknot for mine, because I think it would just be mad and he'd just beat everyone up and make them all do some weird, crazy
music
together.
He's your art director.
He's not an art director. I just wanted to go in and batter everyone and just cause pandemonium in the studio.
His art, though.
I've actually got Jamie Morgan from Code Orange.
Because, I knew you would pick him.
Because I just think, again, he would... There would be no... I don't think there'd be any kind of safety things. The one thing when you get artists like this together is that they always end up sounding like less than the sum of their parts. They just sound, oh, like, here, this song sounds a bit like Fear Factory if they were mixed with Trivium or whatever. I think Jamie and Clown would not allow that. I think they'd just try and do some fucked up stuff, which would be really fun. I've got Becca McIntyre from Marmosets as well, because they are wicked, and I think she's awesome and super high energy. And one of the most talented singers going today, and I'd really be interested to see what she would do singing over and kind of leading some other different musicians. And I got Jason Allen Butler as well from Fear, the Fever 333, because again, he's super experimental. Fever 333, very kind of branching out into other things from what Let Live were, who were already a little bit genre crossing. So him in charge of a rank of really cool musicians would be interesting to see. So those
now mine feels too safe, but I do think yours would be more rocky and less metal-y. I'd sort of maybe pick Clown and Jamie out of your lineup and shove them in mine somewhere.
Well, there you go. Should we do one more question then?
Mm-hmm.
Go on then, Elle.
Marco LG asks, hard Brexit and touring. Whatever your position on Brexit, it is a fact that touring will become more expensive with a hard Brexit, with possible visa issues. Are metal bands ready for that? Is anybody even thinking about it?
Well, whatever people's position on Brexit, I would probably wager that most politicians involved probably aren't thinking about rock and metal bands first and foremost in all of this, because there's a lot of other stuff to untangle, let's be honest. It's something that is worrying for a lot of bands, because, again, you can say that no one knows what will happen, but most of the research does seem to show that it wouldn't be a very easy thing to transition in, especially if there was a hard Brexit. And it is probably something that will be affected. You know, the fact is that when you're suddenly not part of an organization that allows certain freedom of movements and has certain relationships and certain customs in place, going in between those countries, especially when you're crossing not just from the UK but across different countries within Europe, I presume is going to become quite tricky, or at least will change somewhat. So no one really knows what's going to happen, but it doesn't I'll be very surprised if it all just carries on smoothly and there's no issues whatsoever when we're suddenly not involved in whatever current rules and regulations there are for touring across Europe.
Yeah, we were just talking a bit earlier about Orange Goblin situation and them being stuck getting into America, and I imagine we'd see more situations like that where people had to provide a lot more background information and it was trickier to be able to get visas and the wait times and the paperwork would be amplified.
Yeah, I'm wondering if gig prices might go up and also whether or not we'd get so many tours. It might be like when I was a teenager and you'd be like praying and praying and praying for like whatever band to come to the UK and they just never seem to come. And now they seem to all come at some point and it's like, great. Maybe they won't anymore. Maybe it'll be
there's also things to take into account, like currency values and stuff, because when like, you know, X euros is suddenly a lot less pounds because of shit hitting the fan, that drastically affects how monetarily speaking you can afford to actually go across different countries and work all that stuff out as well. So it's a super complex issue. And I, again, you know, there's potential issues with things like medicine and food supplies and all sorts. So I doubt, unfortunately, that metal bands touring is probably that high on the agendas of everyone involved in all this stuff at the moment.
But there's so much logistics.
There's going to be a lot of knock-on effect for sure.
As well, like your kit and your crew, like where's all that coming from? Where are you hiring stuff from? What are people's nationalities? How do you get your merch into another country, etc.? There's just so many. That's like the tip of the iceberg. There's just so many things.
It's one of many, many things that is thrown under a lot of uncertainty by what's going on at the moment, unfortunately. So we will have to see what happens with that. Before we say goodbye, I also want to have a big shout out to Big Red as well. We talked about our favourite bars in London or around England recently. Big Red is very much one of the best metal bars in London, one of the best metal bars in the world, to be honest. And they revealed that they are unfortunately having to close soon because their lease has not been renewed. So they're being forced to move out after 16 years. So if you've ever been to Big Red along Holloway Road in London, you'll know what a great place it is. Loads of gigs there. It's a heartland for things like Battle of the Bands for Bloodstock, Metal to the Masses, I should say. Their Battle of the Bands thing. What? Why are you shaking your head at me?
I saw Battle of the Bands at Nambuka.
Yeah, well, there's lots of places. I've seen a Bloodstock. Don't worry, you can say that. There's many places, but I have specifically watched a Bloodstock thing at Big Red.
That's okay then.
Yes. So it's one of, yes, Nambuka is another place where you can see the Metal to the Masses thing. But Big Red was part of that. And God, loads of great bands have played there over the years. And it's always just been a massive part of the metal scene, especially in North London. So shout out everyone involved in that. And I guess the reason I wanted to say it is because it's one of what seems to be an increasing number of local metal bars and important gig venues. They're getting closed down in England in recent times, and it's starting to get really fucking irritating to see the heart getting ripped out of all these metal scenes in towns around the UK. So I'm not sure what we all need to do about it, but it's getting pretty shit. It's not like Big Red was even a, you know, people were there all the time. It's not like it could be like, oh, we all should have gone there more, like their lease expired and it didn't get renewed. Like,
I know, yeah, I was going to say, like, I don't know what their specific situation is, but we've done investigative features before on Hammer. I think you can read some on our website, and often it's down to the landlords or the council, you know, some factor that's not in anybody's control and that's quite specific to that venue or the business rates. You know, it's just, it is what it is.
It is what it is, and it sucks, and it really, really sucks. And I hope there's a way for this kind of endless tide of great places getting closed down to stop and turn around, and hopefully we can see some more places crop up in place of them. But again, we'll have to see what happens. It sucks, but you know, if you're around Holloway in the next few weeks, go into Big Red and buy a beer, and while you still can, innit? That is it for this week. I'm going to be away for the next two podcasts. Because I am going to be going away to San Francisco next week.
Interesting.
With flowers in your hair?
With flowers in my hair. With flowers in my hair and my metal horns raised to the sky. Maybe when I'm back, I'll have some stuff to talk about.
Are you going to bring us presents? That's all I want to know.
No wee. Oh. But yeah, I'm going to be in San Francisco next week. And yeah, back the week after that. So I'll leave it with you guys. Please don't break anything. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
I'll promise not to break anything if you promise to bring back different flavours of M&Ms.
Oh, you can have caramel flavour.
Yes. I
promise that alone.
We'll do peanut butter, flavors. Peanut butter.
No, I made of money.
Yeah.
Seen the state of the pounds. What do you want me to do? Right. That's it for this week, though. Owen and I will be back next week. Take care of each other, everybody. And appreciate your local venues and bars while you still can.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.